Welcome to Leave Your Mark, where I explore the influences that have shaped the lives of our incredible guests. These are the stories of lives worth talking about. Follow me on Twitter at Built by Scott and Instagram at King O'Pain, or link up with me on my Facebook fan page at Scott G. Livingston. My goal is to create a community of people who take every opportunity to live high-performing lives. Before I get started on today's podcast, I want to take a moment to connect you with my sponsor, ReconditioningHQ.com.
Reconditioning is now completely virtual. This amazing operating system that brings the worlds of therapy and performance together in one powerful package can now be digested from the comfort of your home or personal workspace. Reconditioning is about unleashing the human in human performance. It's about understanding why you or your clients are not performing or living your best life and giving you and your clients the skills for optimal performance. Our courses, R1 Foundations, and R2 Designs take you through a complete process in assessment and intervention. Reconditioning Specialist Mentorship pulls everything together in your operating context, and our landmark program, Empower You, helps you navigate your own life so you can be your very best. For more information about reconditioning courses and programs, head over to reconditioninghq.com and use the coupon code LYM50 for $50 off the price of any one of our empowering courses. Most recently, Matrix Fitness Canada partnered with Playball Academy Canada in Kitchener, Ontario to create the Matrix Conditioning Center. The Matrix Conditioning Center within the facility provides PBA athletes and coaches access to the best and most current conditioning tools to support their development. By combining the Matrix research on product usage with customized needs of the coaches, simple performance metrics are being developed in a body-friendly and progressive way. It is a hybrid model combining high-performance metric analysis with coach-friendly opportunities. Speed training, sprint mechanics, coaching, metabolic conditioning, warm-up, and cool-down are all some of the examples of how these tools are being used. Playball Academy Canada was established in 2014 and has developed into one of the premier indoor baseball training facilities in the country. From grassroots player and skill development to the pro level, the facility and its programming continue to evolve and grow. Matrix Fitness is a global brand of fitness equipment that serves exercisers and operators from all corners of the globe. When it comes to sport performance, Matrix portfolio continues to grow through its partnership with amateur and professional sports organizations globally. To get more information on how Matrix Fitness can customize something for your team, contact Matrix directly at greg.lawler@matrixfitness.com and tell them Leave Your Mark sent you.
I'm excited to announce our newest sponsor, Push. Whether you're coaching your athletes from the gym or remotely, the Push Pro system allows you to make meaningful training progress no matter where you are. The Push Pro system is the only coaching solution that empowers over 5,000 coaches to plan, track, assess, and improve athlete performance using real-time velocity data in one integrated system. Now, for a limited time, you can get 15% off any Push Pro system if you use the discount code PUSHPRO15. Just head to the Push website at www.trainwithpush.com/performance and use the discount code PUSHPRO15 to get 15% off your Push Pro system. So without further ado, I want to introduce Damien Moroney. Damien, maybe you can take us through a little bit of your historical past and who you are and what you do, and then we'll get into some questions.
Great. Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Jamie, for having me. I welcome the opportunity to spend some time with both of you and your extended community. So I appreciate the invite. To frame up, I guess, a bit of my background and experience to give people a bit of a sense, I will also date myself, unfortunately, and age myself slightly. Just for awareness, I came out of school and actually started into physiotherapy school at University of Alberta at the age of 17. You could go straight in out of high school. So I was actually 17 when I started, and I consequently got done. That was in 1988. I consequently finished in 1992 and was done at 21 as a registered and practicing physical therapist. To put that in as a time frame, I didn't have a home computer when we went to school. We could either, type up our reports or we could hand write them and put them in. So, I think consequently the journey that I've been on, that, Scotty's been on, is a very different exploration of what we did in that age compared to what's accessible now to new grads coming up. And so I think that as we engage with athletes and developed and created solutions and connections, we didn't have nearly as much exposure to what was being done in the world. And consequently, we had to kind of seek and place positions of areas that stimulated us, stressed us, challenged us, and allowed us to then kind of form our own hypothesis for a working model in that time frame with, you know, during that time. So, you know, my journey, basically, I worked in a clinic as a physio. I had an interest in sport. But again, as we came out of school, we weren't necessarily taught a wide-ranging exercise program. We weren't introduced really to strength and conditioning. Strength and conditioning wasn't a huge field at that time within sport as we went through things. But over time, it became more and more, and Scotty has alluded to that in his journey in terms of, you know, going through as an NHL strength coach, you know, versus the football strength coach, which had been a more formalized position over time. But I didn't work as much with football through those eras. So as a therapist, first and foremost, I got my manual therapy. I gained my manual skills. But I was always challenged and was interested in sport and the puzzle of sport and what an athlete needed to do in a variety of contexts, and a variability of the different natures of sport. And so I sought out, you know, basically what was out there in exercise therapy initially, sort of Norwegian medical exercise therapy, things like kinetic control, the performance matrix, and worked through sort of a therapeutic model of what I saw was regional issues or regional dysfunction and strategies to improve them, that had then a global component to it in terms of a context of movement and how we would look at those regions within movement. And then, you know, I was fortunate through that time as I started to do some teaching and consulting with organizations and initially through Hockey Canada. Back in the day, I met Jason Poole, who was their primary strength coach, and he was a real motivator within the Calgary Sport Institute. I met Jamie, Scott, Steve Lidstone, a number of people who have been in this profession at that point that were thinkers and creatives. And I had the chance while I was doing work out of CSI Calgary and coming in and doing some lecturing and some presenting, I was so inspired by this hothouse environment of what these professionals were doing and bouncing off of each other. And it was Scott Ma, Matt Jordan, Jason Poole, Stu McMillan, Dave Ellis. I mean, it was just these guys and these thinkers and their approach to wanting to understand athlete preparation for an Olympic level and for an Olympic athlete pushed the boundaries of my thought process. And it was like, I'm thinking in a smaller box here from a rehab model. I'm thinking of these joints and I'm thinking of, because at that time we were very manually therapy oriented and I was looking at stability, but I was still looking at stability within movement. And I wasn't looking at as much at that time at stability under demand of strength, power, impact, change in direction. And when I spent some time, and I would spend every time that I could, any time I was through Calgary, I was based out of Nelson, BC at the time. I'd moved into the mountains. I would try to get in that room, and I would, you know, wait at the back doors, and I would come in and I'd hook up with Matt and Jason Poole and Scott, and it was a chance to just see their thought process and then their application of that to athlete preparation. And it really exposed me in a sense that I didn't necessarily have a full grasp of what at the elite level these athletes needed to do. And through that, I met Jamie and I met Steve Lidstone, through, he brought me out to York. I met Jamie. Jamie brought me up to Montreal to present concepts. And then we ended up, Scott and I ended up working together because, you know, at that time, he was with the Montreal Canadiens, and taking courses was a challenge for him, but he had some budget and could create the opportunity to do something customized and individualized. So we did some work around your coaching group more so, and your therapeutic team more so than the players themselves, and just worked on concepts and ideas and strategies. And from that, then we you invited me into the opportunity to join a group called B210, which was really around the elite Olympic athlete and the structural support organization around them, and then ultimately grassroots and physical literacy sport. But and that was a real opportunity and eye opening and a real privilege. And I think the sense when I reflect back in terms of the privilege to it is, you know, a lot of people go through their lifetime of sport coaching development in a hope to have an athlete that's going to have an Olympic Games and a hope to have an athlete that might podium or have that chance and that opportunity. And they're relatively far and few between. And I think the onus of responsibility that we had and the privilege that we had was a connection to athletes that had the potential to podium right off the bat. And, you know, that meant that how we integrated into their environment, how we engaged them, how we generated or created solutions that had to fit within the group that they had was a challenge at times, but B, a real, as I say, a privilege to be involved in these multitude of athletes' journeys where they only have one opportunity every 4 years and they're trusting you to be part of that. And it's in a variety of sport, and it was summer and winter. And so, you know, every year we'd get done in Olympic Games and I'd be like, if you're in winter sport, you get done, you have a year off, it's a post-Olympic year. For us, it would be like this breath out, and then, okay, now we're in a pre-Olympic year for the next set of Olympics, and which was the next Winter Games. And so everything felt important, and it was important. But the exposure to really good people doing really good things in strength and conditioning, in nutrition, in psychology, and the privilege to engage in those variety of environments gave me an appreciation and a connection and a growth in awareness and understanding of what does it take to rehab and to prepare an athlete for the level and nature of that type of competition. And so I found that you found these really interesting, engaged people at either at all levels, at all professions. You found great massage therapists. You found great chiros. It wasn't disciplinary per se. It was person-based in terms of what did they have, what did they bring, and how do they fit within that individual's either pod, their team environment, their team sport, or whatever it might be. And I think that constant exposure and that constant having to generate ideas and solutions really gave me now an appreciation of the breadth of that experience, and it has consequently shaped me and influenced the direction that I take and maybe some of the synthesis of what I apply into the next project or the next athlete.
Oh, you got another point? Go ahead, sorry.
Oh, I was just going to, you can ask me, we can go there and then I can explain further.
Yeah, one of the things that because I want to draw in for the group, like I love, you've always been a really good critical thinker and one of the things that I admired in your process is your ability to inject yourself into an environment with a particular athlete project issue and recognize what perhaps the problem is, but also recognize relatively rapidly what you want to go after. And I'm just curious if maybe you can present to the crowd how you kind of identify when you see there's a movement problem, you know, whether an athlete is maybe not performing at their best or has an injury that's been reoccurring, etc. What do you kind of look at immediately? What draws your attention? How do you find those, call them drivers of the situation, and get after it relatively rapidly? Because you've really earned your living from kind of going in and figuring that out kind of quickly and then moving through a process. And sometimes you only have a week to make something happen by virtue of the way you operate. So I think it would be really valuable for people to hear sort of your process and how you go after things.
Yeah, it's funny. I think, you know, if I if I'm honest in my appraisal of myself, I would say that that is something that I'm strong at. I would say at the same point, there's a lot of people that are better than me at their manual therapy or their manual skills. There's people that are better read in their research and their application of that evidence into the backbone of what they're presenting or, you know, suggesting as strategies. There's people out there that are a lot better at a lot of things than what I do. I think the uniqueness that I would say probably I have some aspect of is that processing. And I think that creation of a solution, the ability to take something out and coach it back in. And in all honesty, now when I think about it, and I chatted with Rick Celebrini about this one time, and it's like, you realize that you actually have what seems like a relatively a simplistic solution, but it comes with an awareness of a lot of systems that are going together to produce that movement. And I think it goes through your own mental checklist of experience around the nervous system, experience around the ligament system and the joint system. And I think you go through your brain and you say, okay, well, you know, I think the starting point is, what does this athlete need to do? And what are they doing in the field of play? And that's going to differ for a diver versus a skateboarder versus a track and field athlete versus, you know, something that, you know, BMX, freestyle, whatever it might be. What is the variety and variability of what they're doing? What is the structure then? What's my working diagnosis of what structure do I think is creating the pain if it's pain or the injury if it's injury? What do I think is the manifestation of stress that enhances or reproduces that pain? Is it their positional change in direction? Is it under transitional load? Is it as they're generating power or speed? Is it wide open top end speed? Is it the volume of work they're doing, or is it just an unfortunate situation that they had an impact or a trauma or a physics dictated that they were going to be hurt? And then within that, then how am I designing? Where do I think the flaw is in the system under speed or through extremes of range, you know, and what can I do to help limit the frequency of irritation to that structure? Can I then present it to the athlete that it makes sense to them in a way that they have buy-in and understand why we're going down this road? And then ultimately, if I can link it to what they need to do out there or use the language that they use or that their coach, let's say it's a performance deficit, that their coach or agent or, you know, whoever's come to you with the problem, he needs to be faster on his first two steps of acceleration he needs to close quicker to a ball or close quicker on the puck or doesn't pivot left and accelerate well. How do you use that framework of that language that coach's eye or the objective or the athlete needs to do in that environment and create something that links a fairly clear pathway to why you're doing something to ultimately that change in an objective outcome, which is I may need to skate faster or crossovers, accelerations are difficult for me. And so I think those are different strategies. If it's top end speed that I get hurt at, if it's, you know, if it's volume based, then we need to build a better capacity in you to manage that volume. And we need to change your schedule a little bit in terms of how you're ramping those up. So I think the ability to try to pick pieces out and then make it link and then challenge it and then somewhat create some autonomy and ownership of that pattern that doesn't need me there is where I try to go in it. And I think that's sometimes a lot longer process than people think. And then you have your rapid athletes that sometimes will take things on and they'll transition it in quicker. But often it takes a lot more repetition of the same concept than the athlete thinks and that the therapist may think if you actually, and you need to simplify it down to that. So if I give you a simple example, for example, working with hockey, a lot of hockey players have hip issues. So a lot of them have, whether it's an FAI, which is femoral acetabular impingement, whether it's labral damage underpinning that, there can be a morphological change to that joint that you're unable to do anything about that, build up a bone around that CAM lesion. But you fundamentally need to, and that may be surgical, and a number of them do go with surgery. But if I take that player and I say, okay, and we're coaching lunges, right? And I say, I don't want the pelvis to drop as you lunge, and I want your knee to stay stable and keep your knee there. And the player has a half sense of buy-in. They're like, okay, well, whatever. I'll do these lunges because I should do them. But if I can say to you, listen, I lie down on the table and you, I put your leg across and we flex the leg and we add up the leg and we reproduce that pinch and that catching. Now, I can spend a ton of time clearing that, or I could needle it and I can mobilize it and I can clear it. That's great. Or a therapist can clear it, or their massage therapist can clear it. Great. We now have more range that we need to control. But if I now go to them and say, okay, this is the position, let's lie down and do that, good. Now let's stand right up into a lunge, and you put them in a functional lunge. And now let's drop the pelvis from that lunge. And at the same time as they're dropping that, wow, that's actually now dropped into a relatively flexed lead leg that's now relatively adducted compared to where the pelvis went, to where it's the exact same position that you just showed me you have pain in. So if now I say, well, let's lunge but not do that, and control that through the hip. Now, I'm going to more often than not, at least in your training environment, keep you out of that range so that every time you lunge and then lunge under load, you're not just banging into that structure. Now you start to have a strategy to a controlled training environment. Now let's look at that when we actually accelerate it. Let's look at it where we accelerate it on an angle or we do lateral bounding. Can I lateral bound and stack those biomechanics up that the pelvis lines up over the leg better, I absorb load, and I ultimately generate power then out of a position that I didn't relatively go into that same position? Well, that starts to make more sense of them. Now, can I rotate that? Can I drive with a medicine ball and do a rotational throw or absorb rotation into that same position? That if I don't then fundamentally drop in that and I start to get comfortable where I'm driving that force from, I'm going to limit the number of times that I stress that. And now you say, okay, well, that's great, but I still need to shoot off that lead leg and I need to generate power and it's going to be out on the ice. Let's say I don't yet have the ice. Ideally, I want to go out on ice and I want to put them in a Corveo and I want to, you know, stress some resistance through that or coach them through some of those explosive movements on ice. That's ultimately where we'll get the most transference. But let's say we don't have that, or you don't have that accessibility because of the model of where you're at from the clinic. We're fortunate in that we have 8 ice surfaces right beside our facility. And then there's still Burnaby Winter Club and there's still North Shore Winter Club. So we can get out on ice with players and with their like skating instructor and skating coach and start to make it where it actually has transference. But if we don't, then what I'll often do is take them into something like boxing. And I've used boxing a lot lately. Because what do I want you to do? The outcome is I want you to generate balanced power. I want you to be able to drop into it, drive force off of that, and create that same pillar that's a new motor, neuromotor control for you to be aware of, that's teaching you a context of learning that ultimately if you, you know, slip onto that, you know, I slip across and I load that lead leg into a good balanced hip position and I can drive a hard body punch into a power, into a pad from that and pivot around that hip and push back out of that. The outcome was I generated a good crisp power. The methodology was I got into a good hip position. I was in balance. I wasn't outside of my center. I generated that power. I returned to that balanced position and I could then follow it up with another punch or something that's more repetitive up top. So now I can actually teach them something that's a neuromotor pattern that's a challenge to them, that's learning to them, that's still working on the same concept that ideally is linking to ultimately how do we skate better and drive better force and control that hip. So I think it's really taking the creativity of what do I want to do? What do they need to do? Can I get them to limit the stress to it so that they have, when they do bang into, because inevitably they will, not everything will be controlled, that it hasn't been banged into the whole time we've been training, hasn't been banged into the whole time we warmed up prior to going on ice. And then on ice, periodically, I'm going to get into those vulnerable positions, but hopefully I'm at a wider box of threshold that now I can exist better within that. And that context of variability doesn't automatically flare me up.
How have you built, in some sense, sustainability off the backbone of that? Like, I think this is where a lot of people stumble in our industry when we get to that sort of return to sport zone is we may be able to find better shapes. We may be able to find better production of force. We may be able to find and create those kind of interconnections in movement that we want to exhibit. But then it breaks down with fatigue or with the introduction of stimulus that takes away from the focal point. So the addition of a ball, the addition of stick handling, the addition of taking a shot, the addition of reading the play, all these different things that go into sort of the back end of. So how do you approach that so that those things that you've kind of shifted and changed actually stick? What's the stickiness factor there in your opinion?
I think the stickiness is that it's not over time. I think you narrow the confines of what somebody can deal with. And then you allow more to happen around that and repeat it with more challenge to it and still look to stay to at times some of those concepts and accept that not every rep within that is going to be perfect either. I think there's an aspect. I find that there's two things. I think there's, you know, we're too quick to coach. We're too quick to use language and we're too quick to move to the next concept. Like, oh, you did three reps of that. That was good. Let's go. Here's the next thing you got to work on. And so I think one thing first is repetition. And as I said, I think it takes more time than people think. And you know, again, I think that it's a relationship over time with your more, you know, your, it's a little different being in a clinic than being with an elite athlete population. And especially I work less in the team environment. I'm more in the athlete project and individual athletes within either a team environment or, you know, a national team, and, you know, that might still be individualized sport. And so, example, if I have a, you know, an NHL player, we'll do that off season, that first off season, let's say we had a strategy and work, they're going to do the work that I'm going to do with them, working on maybe some of their strategies and movement. Then they're going to move over with our strength and conditioning department, and they're going to work with their strength and power. And we're going to talk together about what some of those strategies are in terms of how do we transfer that link in language or communication between them so that we're coaching into some of those same things at differing times, so that ideally that program is overall consistently reinforcing what our objectives are and then coming back to that through that off season. And then what I found is fundamentally that second off season is significantly better. You're done a lot of that coaching and it's like, we got you through that, but that next season, now if they happen to be coming back into Vancouver and playing and they can come by and their schedule, it works out. Or sometimes they'll do, you know, Edmonton, Calgary, Vancouver, they'll have a day off. And if they can bring their staff in that they're working with, if they've got an interest in going and we can coach through some of those concepts, then we're getting a little more reinforcement. And we've had some great therapy staffs that are super engaged and interested. And that way there's a link to what they're doing through the season. And it's not, you know, like it's not that exciting of work even at that point. It's just reviewing the basics and coaching them and where are you getting them through? What are you looking for? And what do you find relates to where they may break down? And then that second off season is better, you know, and it's, there's more variability to it. They pick it up easier. You can challenge it more and you can start to put it under more load and demand. I work a lot with a physiologist, Ben Spohr, on individual athlete programs. And that's one of the, that's fundamentally where recently I think I've had bigger stick is Ben really helps in setting the structure of the week, the integration of the pieces of the strength and conditioning, the physiological adaptation that we're looking for, the other work that's going to supplement it. And then what we do a lot together is then as we move, not at the beginning, but as we built more of that rudimentary work, then we take it into a model whereby now he tells me the intervals that we're going to do on a, you know, on a 16 minutes of work, that it's going to be, you know, this one's going to be 10 seconds with 5 second rest. We're going to do it 6 times. We're going to repeat it twice. This one's going to be 15 seconds of work. There's going to be 10 seconds of recovery. And then we're going to repeat that 9 times. And then I got to think of, okay, within that, how do I structure, what do I want to do that I'm going to challenge those patterns? What's amenable to that time frame to repeat? And where will I see breakdown of that? And not necessarily coach it through every stage of it, but maybe through the last 15, the last three reps, the last two reps, the last 5 seconds of the first three, and leave it alone and just do some work in that. So I think once you actually start to combine those fields, then the message is more frequently and consistently delivered. And I think that that enables more transference. And again, the more that you can work into drills that are interesting but have a purpose, not just interesting for the sake of, like, don't stand on a BOSU just because it's wobbly and you wobbled around and assume that that was good work. Like, what was the intention behind it? Maybe it's too hard. Maybe it should be flipped over with that hard side up so that they've got a chance to stabilize and get the work that now there's some variability, but it's within a level of challenge that keeps them being able to be at that edge of being successful. And I was thinking about this a little bit coming in, and to me, part of the work we do is a little bit like the way that apps are designed. Like, why is Candy Crush popular? Right? It's an app. What it is it's an ongoing progression of what you're doing. There's ongoing challenges that you fail at periodically, but then you succeed. And then you're like, oh, I wonder what the next thing that's coming is. Oh, you don't get anything from it. You haven't made any money. You've invested a ton of your time in it over time because you keep getting that little stimulus of, oh, there's more. And, oh, there's a harder level. But if you threw all of those levels in at the beginning and you had, you know, expanding jelly blocks and you had cages and you said, you know, that this ice block came in and this was getting like, it's too challenging for that athlete to do it all. But if it's too easy and I just keep doing the same blocks and the same patterns, I'm not going to keep going. Why would I? It doesn't relate to what I am. Yeah, I've done it. So if it's too hard, I shut off. If it's too easy, I don't keep going. So it's that, I think that's a little bit the skill and art in the application of it is how do you challenge it? And then what athletes respond to challenge, competition, criticism. What ones need to be nurtured? What ones need more structured information behind them or more structured programming to make them more responsive over time so that they can, you know, ultimately succeed? Because you've got to develop a strategy that works for the athlete, not for you. And I think that too often we do what makes sense to us because it makes sense to us, right? Well, if you have an athlete that's a creative cat and they're already extremely good at what they do, and they don't do a lot of volume of work in the background, then you've got to move in there slower. Because if you tell them they have to do all of this structured training and it doesn't fit within the way that they work, and if they don't do it, you know, then they're failing. Well, at the same point, they're already the most successful at their sport as it is. So are you right in that? You might want to build a more resilient, a more durable, a better habit-based athlete. But I think that it's fundamentally that's one of the challenges.
You were talking just before you came on, or what before we got into the whole big group being here, and I thought that would be sort of poignant to pivot off of what you were just saying around, you know, today's circumstances and working, you know, like this on Zoom and with video and things like that. And you actually remarked that, you know, it's been relatively easy for you to do some of the work that you've been doing. And what, you know, for the people who maybe don't have access to the athlete or client on a really regular basis, like maybe you or I have had in our careers, and sort of have to come in, make a difference, then try to get that person to stick it and then come back and, you know, play with it again. What would be some of your strategies for doing that well and sort of what to focus on to get that immediate or that movement forward so that the next time you see them on video or however you interact, you can get more traction?
I think make it make sense to them. You know, the more that it makes sense to them, they don't need to reproduce it every time, but they need to know what it feels like, what it looks like, you know, can they do it eyes closed or eyes open? What are their keywords that are simple that are going to, you know, generate that connection to the work you've done? I think it's very hard to start this relationship online. I think it's very hard to, you know, get that buy-in and coach that athlete through that awareness. But I think the more that you can have an established coaching cueing, then you're just going back to those coaching cueing. You're relinking them with the why they're doing it. You're relinking them with the challenge. And then you can look at either fatiguing it, loading it, again, working within the program that they've been assigned, or assigning them a program that's going to sort of feed into what your objectives are in that time frame, and then give them a chance to work through it and give them a chance to know that you're going to have a look at it again. Because we perform much better knowing we're going to be evaluated, tested, reviewed, whatever it might be. And I think that that gives that sort of bond a little bit more and that chance to continue to build. I think it would be a challenge to start it. I have athletes that have full gyms in their house. I have athletes that, as I said, were working with a 20-pound bag of potatoes. They just couldn't eat any of the potatoes. or water jugs or, you know, whatever it might be. So most have scrambled to find something, but we're working. We're rarely at high load weights for this, but we can work at time under tension. We can work still in fatigue state. We can still work at an explosive movements. And so there's ways to continue to challenge it.
What, you mentioned working, by the way, for everybody listening, you're welcome to ask questions, just type them in and Jamie will read them. So if there's something you want to ask, by all means, don't miss this opportunity to talk to, one of the best at what he does in this country. Cause he will be soon gone in about 20 minutes and you won't be able to ask those questions. So fire away. What have been some of your strategies? You mentioned working with Ben. And you've had to work with a lot of, different people who are, and oftentimes top of their game. What have been your strategies for interacting with them respectfully, connecting, making that connection so that you actually can achieve something together? Because that's oftentimes one of the big impediments to success in these projects is people butting heads versus people working together. So what are your strategies for doing that well?
Yeah, I think, when I reflect on the number of environments that I've been in, I've been fortunate. I've had a chance to be down out around the PGA Tour, around Cirque du Soleil. I've done a lot with Red Bull as far back as 2004, since prior to them coming in. I'm still contracted with Red Bull and their athletes and their programs. As you alluded to, you're right. You're coming into an athlete's environment, and that's different coming into a professional team. That's different coming into, let's say a Red Bull athlete. They're already signed on as being likely one of the top in what they do. But again, they're often in these creative pursuits, these artistic sports in a sense, and they don't necessarily have the same structure and awareness behind them. So you have to come into a different context in that group. And then you come into a national team group that often has a very strong structure. And absolutely, I think it's being empathetic to the scenario you're walking into. It's recognizing that it can be threatening unless you have a longer term relationship with somebody. Like if I come into your environment, I don't feel that I would, be there. If I come in and I'm introduced to somebody in the environment that doesn't know me, that is the first response tends to be that's a bit of a threat to what I'm doing or delivering. And especially if it's around injury, because then something's happened and or something's not being resolved. And so there's some strategy. So I think you need to be aware that that is the often the nature, unless they've called you up and said, hey, can you come and take a look at this? Or let's send this athlete out and have a look. So I think that it's being aware of the context of that environment. I think it's being aware of what your role and opportunity is in that, and then being aware of the time frame that you're operating in. And what can I generate, A, in the one day that I've got to look at you, and B, that's going to stick with you as a simple starting point for the next 3-4 weeks or until we connected again. And there was a great analogy from an agent as I went down to connect with a top level golfer. And again, it was a point whereby the strength conditioning coach had, was defensive and felt threatened. And the bottom line is I don't want that job. I'm not going down there to try and get that job. And so if they kind of know that I'm not coming in looking to take the job, you're going to be the guy, you're the team guy, you're involved, it's you, this is your environment, I'm creating a piece of it and I'm stepping away from it. You're going to get, if that athlete responds better and can do more volume and can play more tournaments or is more available on the court, they're going to likely look at, okay, within the structure, that guy's doing a good job. So I'm not coming in to take that job. I don't want to move there. I'm not looking to do that. I'm here to offer some strategies and solutions, and ideally it moves forward. And I think that that agent had a great analogy, which was, you know, as a lawyer, if you have a lawyer that's your day-to-day lawyer and he's managing your business and your accounts and your, you know, what's going on and how you're progressing and how you're moving through, you have full trust in that lawyer. If something happens and there's a, you know, a need for a specialist, you know, then you want to bring that specialist in. That doesn't devalue the daily lawyer you have from day to day, but you want somebody who's looked a lot at that nature of the law that's going to help you deal with that problem. And if that lawyer calls them in, that's not belittling that. That's that network saying, I got a good solution to add to that. And then that lawyer is fundamentally doesn't want to be the day-to-day guy with you anyway. He's not going to then sit through your accounts and your books and your business setups and your management. He's going to get out and go on to the next problem. And I think that was a really good analogy to help frame that coming into context. And so recognize, be empathetic, recognize and empower the people that are around it. Look at it and don't generate an overly complex scenario and situation if you don't have to. Like, don't make it all about your kitchen to where it's this joint doesn't move this amount and therefore it's not gliding, and if it doesn't do that, you're screwed. It's like, what's the general takeaway that actually can be employed within the time frame that you have? And it was interesting, I had one kid that was a draft pick, a high level draft pick, and was sent out to have a look because he'd had ongoing hip and groin stuff and SI pain, and they sent me a report that a physical therapist had done, and it was so detailed on the biomechanics of the joint and what needed to be cleared and what needed to be done. And then the strength coach was working away, and it's like, but the problem was still recurrent. And the end solution was just looked at basically the way that he loaded with lateral bounding and the way that he exploded off of one leg. If you can clean up these two things, if your strategies go towards improving that he's not collapsing and compensating through those two things over the period of time that you have them, likely that's going to reduce the stress on those structures because you reduce the shear, you reduce the ligamentous load, the muscular system's more effective, it anticipates that stress, it generates a strategy around it. Getting those two things better became the summer program, and he played the full season. And I wasn't involved with it. I didn't think I saw him again that summer. We kept in contact around it. But then he went on to not have an issue through the residual part of that season.
The Push Pro system is your all-in-one coaching solution used by professional sports teams in every major league globally. The system includes Portal, an online data management system that helps you program sessions faster, the Push Band 2.0, a wearable accelerometer that tracks key performance metrics, and the Push app that lets you see the velocity and power of each rep in real time. Now, for a limited time, you can get 15% off any Push Pro system if you use the discount code PUSHPRO15. Just head to the Push website at www.trainwithpush.com/performance and use the discount code PUSHPRO15 to get 15% off your Push Pro system.
Matrix Fitness is a global brand of exercise equipment managed locally in the countries it serves. In Canada, Matrix Fitness has 56 employees, 4 offices, a technical support team across Canada covering all regions and serving some of the biggest fitness and hospitality brands in your community. In 2021, Matrix will celebrate its 20th anniversary and 6th year within Canada. An emerging market for Matrix is its sport performance and athletic training portfolio. While Matrix Fitness has gained significant momentum in the fitness market, strength and conditioning is evolving, and for that they need to collaborate with some good people. In the second half of 2020, Matrix launched its own Canadian Ambassador Program, a partnership that looks to do exactly that, work with good people who serve athletes. This is an opportunity to be part of a growing and emerging brand in the ever-changing industry of sport performance. For more information on their ambassador program and exploring the details of how it might work for you, please contact the Vice President of Business Development, Greg Lawler. Please reference the Leave Your Mark podcast and reach out to Greg at greg.lawler@matrixfitness.com.
We got a couple of questions. I think I love the way you're going through all this stuff. It's really brings context and perspective to the thought process. So Jamie's got a couple of cues for you.
Sure.
So Glenn Kinney's asking you, you've talked about getting the athlete to buy in and establish goals. What strategies or techniques do you use to measure whether the goals have been achieved or still require more work?
Yeah, I think those can both be terms of within your training environment. It partly depends on what tools you have for objective measures. For example, now that we've gotten so much more advanced in terms of, practices and timeframes with Catapult and data, like you can actually get like, is the goal to do more high intensity intervals at a certain percentage or level? Well, you can start to prepare for that. And if you're only able to do 16 and you need to do 24, you need to shift those over time. If you don't have that level of, if you have force plates, you can look at the change and the evolution in their reactive strength index and their curve and their slope, and you can start to look at them getting more explosive. But the reality is you don't always have that. And if you don't have or don't have access to that, then fundamentally, can you generate a questionnaire around, how many trials are you successful at? If I give you 10 reps of, trying to do a single leg explosion and stick and you're quiet in your upper body, do you succeed at 6 out of 10 of them? Okay, great. That's done. You don't get to do 10 good ones. You get your trial of 10. And we'll come back to something else, and there'll be another trial throughout your sessions. And so it's that ultimately, can you become more consistently repeatable with less effort over time? You know, something's getting more in when it's done well with less effort, right? Like you see a guy who skis a steep run and it's got bumps on it and their legs look like they just absorb and they make the turns wherever they want to make the turns, and they'll ski it top to bottom. And you'll see somebody else ski that run and they're tight and they're nervous and they're working hard. It's like they're not absorbing it. Same, their muscle system, they're working so much harder both mentally and physically that they're exhausted a third of the way down and they've got a break and take a rest. So how long can you sustain that challenge that I'm asking you to do? And can you, and again, you can put easy scales or metrics on, you can diary it, you can make it a challenge, you can send them home with a challenge. Ultimately, it should get into the field of play. If you have metrics from within the field of play, if you have metrics from their skating times, then you can start to look at how fast they're accelerating, decelerating, like what's their change in direction, what's their 5, 10, 5. You can look at bigger metrics that should ideally host part of that change in their efficiency and effectiveness. But I think that absolutely is a challenge. I think, but you can set up your environment to make it interesting. I've had shoulder rehabs, and I'll mark, we have a big cement wall. We're fortunate in the space we have at Fortius, and we've got a big cement wall, and I'll put 9 different X's on the walls at different spots and different heights. And that shoulder that's rehabbing will now, I'll start with them just throwing at different targets, and then we'll get to where I'll lob a volleyball in, and they'll have to cup it and accelerate it at a target or a number. And they'll work themselves through the pattern. Then I'll change the number. I'll call it late. And they'll have to one-time it as the ball's coming or as they're catching. And how accurate can they be? Or how close are they to hitting those? Can they do it left-handed? Can they do it right-handed? Like, increase the challenge to it and try to still reproduce the strategy you're looking for them. If now they get back into opening up and lagging and it's a poor throwing position, that shoulder's more vulnerable versus the mechanics that I want them to produce in that, if that answers the question.
Awesome. Another question.
Yeah. So Jason is asking about your career trajectory coming out of graduation. So what was that and the books you recommend? And he's just got another little part. It says, at his first job/client, did Damien ever feel like he had to earn respect because he was fresh out of school and seen as inexperienced? So,
yeah, I think that's a great question. Absolutely. I was 21. I looked like your son,
you still look like a baby.
It was 28 years ago. So I was really young and I was cautious of that. And, I was working with therapists that had had more experience, but had a young, had a great attitude and a great engagement, and were, you know, a good solid environment for me to experiment, for me to make mistakes in, for me to grow in, for me to ask questions in. And so I think, you know, even now, 28 years, I'm still challenged by the matrix of all that goes on in an athlete and coming back and injury. And when you think on nutrition and the latest in that and sleep impacts and effects and fascia versus nervous system versus healing of tendons and like, and all the information that's out there. So bottom line, I think twofold. I think you need to explain things that make sense to people. If you can explain something to somebody that makes sense to them, doesn't blow them away with your fancy knowledge, but makes it make sense, and you talk them through it, and you have a strategy for how you're going to change it, you know, you don't necessarily have to tell them how many of them you've done to date. You know, if it's your first ACL, it's your first ACL. If, you know, I might have a different conversation with I don't know how many ACLs behind. Because you've probably seen it before and been through it before. And that's probably the biggest thing to, I wouldn't use the term expertise, but if you've put that out there, expertise is more just experience. You've been through, I would take expertise out of it and just put experience. You've been through more shit. You've seen it go well. You've seen it go wrong. You've seen it fail. You've seen it do well. And you have a sense of where that person fits in that paradigm. Then you know their mental approach and their aspect. You know what their give is in this process. Some people give more, some people give less. Some you've got to hold them back. Some they're overly confident. You got to slow them down. So there is an experience level of having been through it over a multitude of times that gives you a breadth of where that first person fits in and probably gives a little more seniority to those conversations. But if you simplify it down, you gain respect by explaining it at a level that they understand, and having a strategy on how you're going to deal with them, giving them some accountability to it, and allowing them to go off. You don't own their time away from you. They'll come back and say, oh, you're going to be so mad I didn't do my exercise. I don't care if you didn't do your exercises. It doesn't really fundamentally affect me. I'm going to sleep just fine tonight. Here's what I would suggest you do. You can do it or not. So it's, you know, give them some accountability to them, allow it to work with them. That's what I'll do often in the gym is I'll walk away and let them, you know, I'll just give them a little space to work through it and come back and recheck it. Let's see what you've done. You know, like I don't need to hover over every rep and every set and coach every bit. Give them some time to figure it out. So that was the first part of the question, I think, is basically give them the, you know, create the answer and create it in a language that makes sense to them. What was the other thing? Books. There's so many resources online. If you search in, you know, and you'll see the names start popping up, you know, Joe Cook with tendons, Heath Barr with tendons, ACL, Tim Gavin. There's so much reference of information that I think, you know, even the dialogues that go on podcasts and Twitter, like you can search, there's so many, you know, Reconditioning HQ has, you know, has had great conversations. Again, the quality of speakers with experience that have been on and are available. Like you had a great group with Joycey and a number of professionals. Like you have access to an hour of these professionals' time. I think you're going to probably get more out of that than a book per se. You know, it's going to reframe. Now go out and do some digging in on what do I need to know more about? I need to know more about the SI joint. I need to know more about the lumbar spine, whatever that might be. But I don't know that there's an like often the answers, you think those books were put out at one time and things continue to evolve. But get into the speakers and find what some of their ideas and philosophies and motivations are, because it will stimulate your own thought process. Secondarily, critically evaluate what you're taught. I mean, I will have, you know, therapists that will tell me this is the best approach. It's the best approach at that moment for them. And I think that they should be able to challenge it. You know, I should sit on your course and challenge things that you're given, because anytime you're putting out a process, if there's a challenge to that in an individual nature. And I need to figure out what I've done in my past background. I need to figure out how I'm going to coach it. I need to take pieces of that and integrate them into me as a practitioner, but I need to be exposed to them to understand them, and then I can harness them down. But I think anytime we get dogmatic in one approach is to the detriment of A, that individual, and B, probably over time the client. It can be a strategy to give me a framework to ask and answer questions from a starting standpoint as I'm younger and as I'm more junior, but know that you should start to, as you've worked with it and you've worked through it, you should start to see the ones that don't respond to it. And you should start to be able to challenge it out and say, what do I, you know, how do I go on a different tangent and look at what worked in this scenario, right? Maybe the same principles, but it applied in a different way. Or somebody else's technique comes back into that. And know that a lot of these techniques are influenced by a lot of other aspects. So I think that hopefully helps out a little bit for you.
That's beautiful. Did we have any other questions? No. My last question before we say good day. Just on the, you've spoken a lot about understanding what the person does and understanding sort of the language so that you can communicate on their terms. What have been some of your practices to, I guess, prepare for that consult? So let's say you get a call to go and work with a golfer, and maybe, you know, I know you play golf and so you have that acumen and stuff, but maybe you don't. So
yeah.
How do you become prepared to walk in that room and understand what it is that they do with their body?
I think that's excellent. I'll try to keep this somewhat short-winded, but probably won't. But I'll give you an example. So I think the thing is, you don't need to be an expert in it. That's one of the things. You need to understand stress, strain, where and why. The coach is the expert, right? Or the athlete's the expert. They understand the nature of the sport. So an example would be luge. And years ago, as I was working with Jason Poole and doing some work around hockey, at that time, Jason Poole was a strength coach. You know, people may now know him as CSI Calgary, but he was a strength coach. And the programs he was responsible was women's hockey, luge, water polo, and wrestling. Huge diversity of sport. And you know, one's, you know, the level of different of nature of training for each of those is fascinating in and of itself. But he said, hey, listen, can you come and look at the losers next? And we have a thing called where they'll lose their head. And I was like, oh shit, that sounds tough. Well, what does that mean? And they basically, under G forces, when they get into a high G corner, if the G's overwhelm them, then their head snaps back and they bounce along the ice until the G's go down and they can lift their head back up and they continue sliding. And I was like, wow, that sounds awful. And it's the same skeleton, except it happens forward. Skeleton lies and they'll drag and they'll bang their chin along the ice and you'll see the scratch marks on the helmet. And then the G-force will go down, they'll bring their heads back up. And I said, okay, well, I was like, you know, in my head, I got a bunch of ideas. I'm like, okay, well, tell me what you've done. You know, like, what have you done today? And he basically lifted off everything that you think of. It was like, okay, we've used weights, we've used bands, we've used isometric work, we've used through weights. We've got a helmet with weights on it. I was like, well, okay. So it sounds like you've done a lot of really good work. I don't know anything about luge. So I'm going to be really reticent to tell you what the answer is because you've been working in it, explored it, tried to generate a solution around it, and it's still a problem. So I've got to be really careful going into that scenario because I don't know, but there's still a problem. There's something that's different. So in that scenario, what we did was I said, okay, well, listen, let's go look at it, but let's put them in their gear, look at them with the helmet on. Look at whatever they do. Let's get them on the sled, put them in the position. Give me one athlete that it doesn't happen to. Give me one athlete that it happens frequently to, like one of your lesser ones that, you know, it's like they'll say it happens 50 times in a season. I want that one. And I want one that it, you know, maybe once or twice, maybe zero. And I want your coach. I want the technical luge coach because I don't want to give a solution that fundamentally doesn't then work in the sport. Right. And we went out and it was a really interesting process and I won't go into it too far, but bottom line was the difference between the two was the one that had the strength to stay in a midline position and could then move the cranial vertebral region separate too and still hold that against force had the ability to better withstand those G forces. And the other one had to use an all or nothing strategy of just rigidity and they could just lock all the structures up and hold. And the interesting thing was they still had a chin strap around and then a strap that attached to the chin strap that then went down and around your thighs and that they would cinch up to try to hold. But the ones who lost their head just pivoted it around that holding point and still banged their way down until they could bring it up. But the ones that lost it had to be all or nothing. They had to lock in and they had to use everything. And they were on the threshold of doing everything they could, that then when they got overpowered or the G's became too much, there was no options. They would just then get slammed back. It was like it would go right through it, and then they would go off. But the ones who didn't had the ability to slide more calmly, you'd see them look up, they could go back into a more aerodynamic position. And so the training program became, how do we create that athlete to look more like that athlete? And that was without, I didn't have to be a loser, but I had to know that it fit. When I went down in with golf, it was like, I sat at the back, I didn't say anything, I didn't try to put in any ideas. I watched the player swing and I listened to the coach that was asking him to do something that he wasn't responding to, or he would be able to do once or twice and would lose it. And then we would take it back, figure out why that was happening, put a strategy in place. We actually canceled the next lesson. That could have probably got us into trouble, but he had enough autonomy. We worked the drills to make it more repetitive, more natural to him. And then when he walked back out and responded immediately to the coach cueing and hit it flush and looked good doing it and could repeat it a couple times, the coach was on board. Now he's like, I don't know what you've done, but that's great. Because it fit his paradigm. Fundamentally, I'm gone after that. I'm not making that golf coach, if that player is successful, is going to have a built up career on the name of that. So now we might have to revisit. It's not in there. It's not automatically part of it. We need to, like, you're going to have to hit at it repeatedly. And you might have to have drills that you do, especially when you're away or you're fatigued or you're coming off the plane. Here's how you're getting back in touch with that lesson back in that day. Remember that summer session? Here's what we had to do. How do you partly self-correct that? And that's what warm-ups are in mobility.
Beautiful response. And you came in just a minute over time, but that's beautiful, buddy. I knew you'd be highly entertaining as normal, and always look forward to spending time with you. It's not anywhere near enough anymore, but we live on opposite ends of the country, so, and now you can't fly anywhere. So
I know, it's quite crazy. So yeah, hopefully we'll cross paths soon. I know that you were scheduled to come out west. I know you've gone virtual, but hopefully we'll cross paths soon. But thank you for the time. Thank you for the engagement, and yeah, it was really fun.
Thank you for the time, sir, and thank you, everybody, for coming out today. Thanks for joining us today on Leave Your Mark. I hope we've left a mark on you today, and we wish only that you pay it forward by sharing this story, taking the time to rate and comment on this podcast. Please follow us at Twitter at Built by Scott and Instagram at King O'Payne, and become a member of this community at Scott G. Livingston on Facebook. Have a great day. Music by Cedric de Saint-Rome.